Side 15. In the conference room, they seated themselves on low chairs, an evident concession to Western tastes, around a low lacquered table, and tea was poured. In Ellie's field of view, beyond the window, was the city of Tokyo. She was spending much time before windows, she thought. The newspaper was the Asahi Shimbun, the Rising Sun News, and she was interested to see that one of the political reporters was a woman, a rarity by the standards of the American and Soviet media. Japan was engaged in a national reassessment of the role of women. Traditional male privileges were being surrendered slowly in what seemed to be an unreported street-by-street battle. Just yesterday, the president of a firm called Nano Electronics had bemoaned to her that there wasn't a girl in Tokyo who still knew how to tie an obi. As with clip-on bow ties, an easily donned simulacrum had captured the market. Japanese women had better things to do than spend half an hour every day wrapping and tucking. The reporter was dressed in an austere business suit, the hem falling to her calves. To maintain security, no press visitors were permitted at the Hokkaido machine site. Instead, when crew members or project officials came to the main island of Honshu, they routinely scheduled a round of interviews with the Japanese and foreign news media. As always, the questions were familiar. Reporters all over the world had nearly the same approach to the machine, if you made a few allowances for local idiosyncrasies. Was she pleased that after the American and Soviet disappointments, a machine was being built in Japan? Did she feel isolated in the northern island of Hokkaido? Was she concerned because the machine components being used in Hokkaido had been tested beyond the strictures of the message? Before 1945, this district of the city had been owned by the Imperial Navy. And indeed, immediately adjacent, she could see the roof of the Naval Observatory, its two silver domes housing telescopes still used for timekeeping and calendrical functions. They were gleaming in the noonday sun. Why did the machine include a dodecahedron and the three spherical shells called bezels? Yes, the reporters understood that she didn't know, but what did she think? She explained that on an issue of this sort, it was foolish to have an opinion in the absence of evidence. They persisted, and she pleaded the virtues of a tolerance for ambiguity. If there was a real danger, should they send robots instead of people, as a Japanese artificial intelligence expert had recommended? Are there any personal effects she would be taking with her? Any family pictures? Microcomputers? A Swiss Army knife? Ellie noticed two figures emerge through a trap door onto the roof of the nearby observatory. Their faces were obscured by visors. They were garbed in the blue-gray quilted armor of medieval Japan. Brandishing wooden staffs taller than they were, they bowed one to another, paused for a heartbeat, and then pummeled and parried for the next half hour. Her answers to the reporters became a little stilted. She was mesmerized by the spectacle before her. No one else seemed to notice. The staffs must have been heavy, because the ceremonial combat was slow, as if they were warriors from the ocean bottom. Had she known Dr. Lunacharsky and Dr. Sukhavati for many years before the receipt of the message? What about Dr. Ada? Mr. Shi? What did she think of them, their accomplishments? How well were the five of them getting on? Indeed, she marveled to herself that she was a member of such a select group. What were her impressions of the quality of the Japanese components? What could she say about the meeting the five had had with Emperor Akihito? Were their discussions with Shinto and Buddhist leaders part of a general effort by the machine project to gain the insights of world religious figures before the machine was activated, or just a courtesy to Japan as the host country? Did she think the device could be a Trojan horse or a doomsday machine? In her answers, she tried to be courteous, succinct, and non-controversial. The machine project public relations officer who had accompanied her was visibly pleased. Abruptly, the interview was over. They wished her and her colleagues all success, the managing editor said. They had every expectation of interviewing her when she returned. They hoped she would visit Japan often afterward. Her hosts were smiling and bowing. The quilted warriors had retreated down the trapdoor. She could see her security people, eyes darting outside the now open door of the conference room. On the way out, she asked the woman reporter about the apparitions from medieval Japan.
"Oh, yes," she replied. "They are astronomers for the Coast Guard. They practice kendo at their lunch hour every day. You can set your watch by them."
She had been born on the Long March and had fought the Kuomintang as a youngster during the revolution. He served as an intelligence officer in Korea, rising eventually to a position of authority over Chinese strategic technology. But in the Cultural Revolution, he was publicly humiliated and condemned to domestic exile, although later he was rehabilitated with some fanfare. One of Xi's crimes in the eyes of the Cultural Revolution had been to admire some of the ancient Confucian virtues, and especially one passage from the Great Learning, which for centuries before every Chinese with even a rudimentary education knew by heart. It was upon this passage, Sun Yat-sen had said, that his own revolutionary nationalist movement at the beginning of the 20th century was based. The ancients, who wished to illustrate illustrious virtue throughout the kingdom, first ordered well their own states. Wishing to order well their states, they first regulated their families. Wishing to regulate their families, they first cultivated their persons. Wishing to cultivate their persons, they first rectified their hearts. Wishing to rectify their hearts, they first sought to be sincere in their thoughts. Wishing to be sincere in their thoughts, they first extended to the utmost their knowledge. Such extension of knowledge lay in the investigation of things. Thus, she believed, the pursuit of knowledge was central for the well-being of China. But the Red Guards had thought otherwise. During the Cultural Revolution, she had been consigned as a worker on an impoverished collective farm in Ningxia Province, near the Great Wall, a region with a rich Muslim tradition, where, while plowing an unpromising field, he uncovered an intricately ornamented bronze helmet from the Han Dynasty. When re-established in the leadership, he turned his attention from strategic weapons to archaeology. The Cultural Revolution had attempted to sever a 5,000-year-old continuous Chinese cultural tradition. Xi's response was to help build bridges to the nation's past. Increasingly, he devoted his attention to the excavation of the underground funerary city of Xian. It was there that the great discovery had been made of the terracotta army of the emperor after whom China itself was named. His official name was Qin Shi Huangdi, but through the vagaries of transliteration had come to be widely known in the West as Qin. In the 3rd century BC, Qin unified the country, built the Great Wall, and compassionately decreed that upon his death, lifelike terracotta models be substituted for the members of his entourage, soldiers, servants, and nobles, who, according to earlier tradition, would have been buried alive with his body. The terracotta army was composed of 7,500 soldiers, roughly a division. Every one of them had distinct facial features. You could see that people from all over China were represented. The emperor had welded many separate and warring provinces into one nation. A nearby grave contained the almost perfectly preserved body of the Marchioness of Tai, a minor functionary in the emperor's court. The technology for preserving bodies, you could clearly see the severe expression on the face of the Marchioness, refined perhaps from decades of dressing down the servants, was vastly superior to that of ancient Egypt. Qin had simplified the writing, codified the law, built roads, completed the Great Wall, and unified the country. He also confiscated weapons. While he was accused of massacring scholars who criticized his policies and burning books because some knowledge was unsettling, he maintained that he had eliminated endemic corruption and instituted peace and order. She was reminded of the Cultural Revolution. He imagined reconciling these conflicting tendencies in the heart of a single person. Quinn's arrogance had reached staggering proportions.
To punish a mountain that had offended him, he ordered it denuded of vegetation and painted red, the color worn by condemned criminals. Quinn was great, but he was also mad. Could you unify a collection of diverse and contentious nations without being a little mad? You'd have to be crazy even to attempt it, she laughingly told Ellie. With increasing fascination, she had arranged for massive excavations at Xi'an. Gradually, he became convinced that the Emperor Qin himself was also lying in wait, perfectly preserved, in some great tomb near the disinterred terracotta army. Nearby, according to ancient records, was also buried under a great mound a detailed model of the nation of China in 210 BC, with every temple and pagoda meticulously represented. The rivers, it was said, were made of mercury, with the emperor's barge in miniature perpetually navigating his underground domain. When the ground at Xi'an was found to be contaminated with mercury, Xi's excitement grew. Xi had unearthed a contemporary account that described a great dome the emperor had commissioned to overarch this miniature realm, called, like the real one, the Celestial Kingdom. As written Chinese had hardly changed in 2,200 years, he was able to read the account directly, without benefit of an expert linguist. A chronicler from the time of Qin was speaking to Xi directly. Many nights Xi would put himself to sleep trying to envision the great Milky Way that sundered the vault of the sky in the domed tomb of the great emperor, and the night ablaze with comets which had appeared at his passing to honor his memory. The search for Qin's tomb and for his model of the universe had occupied Xi over the last decade. He had not found it yet, but his quest had captured the imagination of China. It was said of him, "There are a billion people in China, but there is only one Xi." In a nation slowly easing restraints on individuality, he was seen as exerting a constructive influence. Qin, it was clear, had been obsessed by immortality. The man who gave his name to the most populous nation on Earth, the man who built what was then the largest structure on the planet, was, predictably enough, afraid he would be forgotten. So he caused more monumental structures to be erected. Preserved or reproduced for the ages the bodies and faces of his courtiers, built his own still elusive tomb and world model, and sent repeated expeditions into the Eastern Sea to seek the elixir of life. He complained bitterly of the expense as he launched each new voyage. One of these missions involved scores of ocean-going junks and a crew of 3,000 young men and women. They never returned, and their fate is unknown. The water of immortality was unavailable. Just 50 years later, wet rice agriculture and iron metallurgy suddenly appeared in Japan, developments that profoundly altered the Japanese economy and created a class of warrior aristocrats. Xi argued that the Japanese name for Japan clearly reflected the Chinese origin of Japanese culture, the land of the rising sun. "Where would you have to be standing," Xi asked, "for the sun to be rising over Japan?" So the very name of the daily newspaper that Ellie had just visited was, Xi proposed, a reminder of the life and times of the Emperor Qin. Ellie thought that Qin made Alexander the Great a schoolyard bully by comparison. Well, almost. If Qin had been obsessed with immortality, Xi was obsessed with Qin. Ellie told him about her visit to Sol Haddon in Earth orbit, and they agreed that were the Emperor Qin alive in the waning years of the 20th century, Earth orbit is where he would be. She introduced Xi to Haddon by videophone, and then left them to talk alone. Xi's excellent English had been honed during his recent involvement in the transfer of the crown colony of Hong Kong to the Chinese People's Republic. They were still talking when the Methuselah set, and had to continue through the network of communication satellites in geosynchronous orbit. They must have hit it off. Soon after, Haddon requested that the activation of the machine be synchronized so that he would be overhead at that moment. He wanted Hokkaido in the focus of his telescope, he said, when the time came. Do Buddhists believe in God or not? Ellie asked on their way to have dinner with the abbot.
Oh, their position seems to be, Vege replied dryly, that their God is so great, he doesn't even have to exist.
As they sped through the countryside, they talked about Utsumi, the abbot of the most famous Zen Buddhist monastery in Japan. A few years before, at ceremonies marking the 50th anniversary of the destruction of Hiroshima, Utsumi had delivered a speech that commanded worldwide attention. He was well-connected in Japanese political life and served as a kind of spiritual advisor to the ruling political party, but he spent most of his time in monastic and devotional activities.
His father was also the abbot of a Buddhist monastery, Sukhavati mentioned.
Ellie raised her eyebrows.
Don't look so surprised. Marriage was permitted to them, like the Russian Orthodox clergy. Isn't that right, Vege?
That was before my time, he said a little distractedly.
The restaurant was set in a grove of bamboo and was called Ungetsu, the clouded moon. And indeed, there was a clouded moon in the early evening sky. Their Japanese hosts had arranged that there be no other guests. Ellie and her companions removed their shoes and, padding in their stocking feet, entered a small dining room which looked out on stalks of bamboo. The abbot's head was shaved, his garment a robe of black and silver. He greeted them in perfect colloquial English, and his Chinese, she later told her, turned out to be passable as well. The surroundings were restful, the conversation lighthearted. Each course was a small work of art. Edible jewels. She understood how Nouvelle Cuisine had its origins in the Japanese culinary tradition. If the custom were to eat the food blindfolded, she would have been content. If, instead, the delicacies were brought out only to be admired and never to be eaten, she would also have been content. To look and eat both was an intimation of heaven. Ellie was seated across from the abbot and next to Lunacharsky. Others inquired about the species, or at least the kingdom of this or that morsel. Between the sushi and the ginkgo nuts, the conversation turned, after a fashion, to the mission.
But why do we communicate? The abbot asked.
To exchange information, replied Lunacharsky,
seemingly devoting full attention to his recalcitrant chopsticks.
But why do we wish to exchange information?
Because we feed on information. Information is necessary for our survival. Without information, we die.
Lunacharsky was intent on a ginkgo nut that slipped off his chopsticks each time he attempted to raise it to his mouth. He lowered his head to meet the chopsticks halfway.
I believe, continued the abbot, that we communicate out of love or compassion.
He reached with his fingers for one of his own ginkgo nuts and placed it squarely in his mouth.
Then you think, she asked, that the machine is an instrument of compassion? You think there is no risk?
I can communicate with a flower, he went on as if in response. I can talk to a stone. You would have no difficulty understanding the beings, that is the proper word, of some other world.
I am perfectly prepared to believe that the stone communicates to you, Lunacharsky said, chewing on the ginkgo nut. He had followed the abbot's example. But I wonder about you communicating to the stone. How would you convince us that you can communicate with a stone? The world is full of error. How do you know you are not deceiving yourself?
Ah, scientific skepticism.
The abbot flashed a smile that Ellie found absolutely winning. It was innocent, almost childlike.
To communicate with a stone, you must become much less preoccupied. You must not do so much thinking, so much talking. When I say I communicate with a stone, I am not talking about words. The Christians say, in the beginning was the word. But I am talking about a communication much earlier, much more fundamental than that.
It's only the Gospel of St. John that talks about the Word, Ellie commented,
A little pedantically, she thought, as soon as the words were out of her mouth. The earlier synoptic gospels say nothing about it. It's really an accretion from Greek philosophy. What kind of pre-verbal communication do you mean?
Your question is made of words. You ask me to use words to describe what has nothing to do with words.
Let me see. There is a Japanese story called The Dream of the Ants. It is set in the kingdom of the ants. It is a long story, and I will not tell it to you now. But the point of the story is this: to understand the language of the ants, you must become an ant.
The language of the ants is, in fact, a chemical language, said Lunacharsky, eyeing the abbot keenly. They lay down specific molecular traces to indicate the path they have taken to find food. To understand the language of the ants, I need a gas chromatograph or a mass spectrometer. I do not need to become an ant.
Probably. That is the only way you know to become an ant, returned the abbot, looking at no one in particular. Tell me, why do people study the signs left by the ants?
Well, Ellie offered, I guess an entomologist would say it's to understand the ants and ant society. Scientists take pleasure in understanding.
But that is only another way of saying that they love the ants.
She suppressed a small shudder.
Yes, but those who fund the entomologists say something else. They say it's to control the behavior of ants, to make them leave a house they've infested, say, or to understand the biology of soil for agriculture. It might provide an alternative to pesticides. I guess you could say there's some love of the ants in that, Ellie mused.
But it's also in our self-interest, said Lunacharsky. The pesticides are poisonous to us as well.
Why are you talking about pesticides in the midst of such a dinner? Shot Sukhavati from across the table.
We will dream the dream of the ants another time,
the abbot said softly to Ellie, flashing again that perfect, untroubled smile. Reshod with the aid of meter-long shoehorns, they approached their small fleet of automobiles, while the serving women and proprietress smiled and bowed ceremoniously. Ellie and she watched the abbot enter a limousine with some of their Japanese hosts.
I asked him if he could talk with a stone. Could he communicate with the dead?
She told her. And what did he say?
He said the dead were easy. His difficulties were with the living.
Chapter 18 Super Unification. A rough sea, stretched out over Sado, the Milky Way. Matsuo Basho, 1644-94, poem. Perhaps they had chosen Hokkaido because of its maverick reputation. The climate required construction techniques that were highly unconventional by Japanese standards, and this island was also the home of the Ainu, the hairy aboriginal people, still despised by many Japanese. Winters were as severe as the ones in Minnesota or Wyoming. Hokkaido posed certain logistical difficulties, but it was out of the way in case of a catastrophe, being physically separated from the other Japanese islands. It was by no means isolated, however, now that the 51-kilometer-long tunnel connecting it with Honshu had been completed. It was the longest submarine tunnel in the world. Hokkaido had seemed safe enough for the testing of individual machine components, but concern had been expressed about actually assembling the machine in Hokkaido. This was, as the mountains that surrounded the facility bore eloquent testimony, a region surging with recent volcanism. One mountain was growing at the rate of a meter a day. Even the Soviets, Sakhalin Island was only 43 kilometers away across the Soya, or La Pérouse Strait, had voiced some misgivings on this score. But in for a kopeck, in for a ruble. For all they knew, even a machine built on the far side of the moon could blow up the earth when activated. The decision to build the machine was the key fact in assessing dangers. Where the thing was built was an entirely secondary consideration. By early July, the machine was once again taking shape. In America, it was still embroiled in political and sectarian controversy, and there were apparently serious technical problems with the Soviet machine. But here, in a facility much more modest than that in Wyoming, the dowels had been mounted and the dodecahedron completed, although no public announcement had been made. The ancient Pythagoreans, who first discovered the dodecahedron, had declared its very existence a secret, and the penalties for disclosure were severe. So perhaps it was only fitting that this house-sized dodecahedron, halfway around the world and 2,600 years later, was known only to a few. The Japanese project director had decreed a few days' rest for everyone. The nearest city of any size was Obihiro, a pretty place at the confluence of the Yubetsu and Tokachi rivers. Some went to ski on strips of unmelted snow on Mount Asahi, others to dam thermal streams with a makeshift rock wall, warming themselves with the decay of radioactive elements cooked in some supernova explosion billions of years before. A few of the project personnel went to the Bamba races, in which massive draft horses pulled heavy ballasted sledges over parallel strips of farmland. But for a serious celebration, the five flew by helicopter to Sapporo, the largest city on Hokkaido, situated less than 200 kilometers away. Propitiously enough, they arrived in time for the Tanabata festival. The security risk was considered small, because it was the machine itself, much more than these five people, that was essential for the success of the project. They had undergone no special training, beyond thorough study of the message, the machine and the miniaturized instruments they would take with them. In a rational world, they would be easy to replace, Ellie thought, although the political impediments in selecting five humans acceptable to all members of the World Machine Consortium had been considerable. She and Vege had unfinished business, they said, which could not be completed except over sake. So she, Devi Sukhavati, and Aboni Baeda found themselves guided by their Japanese hosts along one of the side streets of the Adori Promenade, past elaborate displays of paper streamers and lanterns, pictures of leaves, turtles, and ogres, and appealing cartoon representations of a young man and woman in medieval costume. Between two buildings was stretched a large piece of sailcloth on which had been painted a peacock rampant. She glanced at Ada in his flowing embroidered linen robe and high stiff cap, and at Sukhavati in another stunning silk sari, and delighted in the company. The Japanese machine had so far passed all the prescribed tests, and a crew had been agreed upon that was not merely representative, if imperfectly, of the population of the planet, but which included genuine individuals not stamped out by the official cookie cutters of five nations. Every one of them was in some sense a rebel. Ada, for instance. Here he was, the great physicist, the discoverer of what was called superunification, one elegant theory which included as special cases physics that ran the gamut from gravitation to quarks. It was an achievement comparable to Isaac Newton's or Albert Einstein's, and Ada was being compared to both. He had been born a Muslim in Nigeria, not unusual in itself, but he was an adherent of an unorthodox Islamic faction called the Ahmadiyya, which encompassed the Sufis. The Sufis, he explained, after the evening with Abbot Utsumi, were to Islam what Zen was to Buddhism. Ahmadiyya proclaimed a jihad of the pen, not the sword. Despite his quiet, indeed humble demeanor, Ada was a fierce opponent of the more conventional Muslim concept of jihad, holy war, and argued instead for the most vigorous free exchange of ideas. In this, he was an embarrassment for much of conservative Islam, and opposition to his participation in the machine crew had been made by some Islamic nations. Nor were they alone. A black Nobel laureate, said occasionally to be the smartest person on earth, proved too much for some who had masked their racism as a concession to the new social amenities. When Ada visited Tyrone Free in prison 4 years earlier, there was a marked upsurge in pride among black Americans, and a new role model for the young. Ada brought out the worst in the racists and the best in everyone else.
The time necessary to do physics is a luxury, he told Ellie. There are many people who could do the same if they had the same opportunity. But if you must search the streets for food, you will not have enough time for physics. It is my obligation to improve conditions for young scientists in my country.
As he had slowly become a national hero in Nigeria, he spoke out increasingly about corruption, about an unfair sense of entitlement, about the importance of honesty in science and everywhere else, about how great a nation Nigeria could be. It had as many people as the United States in the 1920s, he said. It was rich in resources, and its many cultures were a strength. If Nigeria could overcome its problems, he argued, it would be a beacon for the rest of the world. Seeking quiet and isolation in all other things, on these issues he spoke out. Many Nigerian men and women, Muslims, Christians, and animists, the young, but not only the young, took his vision seriously. Of Eda's many remarkable traits, perhaps the most striking was his modesty. He rarely offered opinions. His answers to most direct questions were laconic. Only in his writings, or in spoken language, after you knew him well, did you glimpse his depth. Amidst all the speculation about the message and the machine and what would happen after its activation, Ada had volunteered only one comment. In Mozambique, the story goes, monkeys do not talk, because they know if they utter even a single word, some man will come and put them to work. With such a voluble crew, it was strange to have someone as taciturn as Ada. Like many others, Ellie paid especial attention to even his most casual utterances. He would describe as foolish errors his earlier only partly successful version of superunification. The man was in his 30s, and Ellie and Devi had privately agreed, devastatingly attractive. He was also, she knew, happily married to one wife. She and their children were in Lagos at the moment. A stand of bamboo cuttings that had been planted for such occasions was adorned, festooned, indeed weighed down with thousands of strips of colored paper. Young men and women especially could be seen augmenting the strange foliage. The Tanabata Festival is unique in Japan for its celebration of love. Representations of the central story were displayed on multi-paneled signs, and in a performance on a makeshift outdoor stage, two stars were in love, but separated by the Milky Way. Only once a year, on the seventh day of the seventh month of the lunar calendar, could the lovers contrive to meet, provided it did not rain. Ellie looked up at the crystalline blue of this alpine sky and wished the lovers well. The young man star, the legend went, was a Japanese sort of cowboy, and was represented by the A7 dwarf star, Altair. The young woman was a weaver, and represented by Vega. It seemed odd to Ellie that Vega should be central to a Japanese festival a few months before machine activation. But if you survey enough cultures, you will probably find interesting legends about every bright star in the sky. The legend was of Chinese origin, and had been alluded to by Xi when she had heard him years ago at the first meeting of the World Message Consortium in Paris. In most of the big cities, the Tanabata Festival was dying. Arranged marriages had ceased to be the norm, and the anguish of the separated lovers no longer struck so responsive a chord as it once had. But in a few places, Sapporo, Sendai, a few others, the festival grew more popular each year. In Sapporo, it had a special poignancy because of the still widespread outrage at Japanese Ainu marriages. There was an entire cottage industry of detectives on the island who would, for a fee, investigate the relatives and antecedents of possible spouses for your children. Ainu ancestry was still held to be a ground for summary rejection. Davy, remembering her young husband of many years before, was especially scathing. Ada, doubtless, had heard a story or two along the same line, but he was silent. The Tanabata Festival in the Honshu city of Sendai was now a staple on Japanese television for people who now could rarely see the real Altair or Vega. She wondered if the Vegans would continue broadcasting the same message to the Earth forever. Partly because the machine was being completed in Japan, it received considerable attention in the television commentary accompanying this year's Tanabata Festival. But the Five, as they were now sometimes called, had not been required to appear on Japanese television, and their presence here in Sapporo for the festival was not generally known. Nevertheless, Ada, Sukhavati, and she were readily recognized, and they made their way back to the Abori promenade to the accompaniment of polite scattered applause by passers-by. Many also bowed. A loudspeaker outside a music shop blared a rock and roll piece that Ellie recognized. It was "I Want a Ricochet Off You" by the black musical group White Noise. In the afternoon sun was a roomy-eyed elderly dog, which, as she approached, wagged its tail feebly. Japanese commentators talked of Mashindo, the way of the machine, the increasingly common perspective of the Earth as a planet, and of all humans sharing an equal stake in its future. Something like it had been proclaimed in some, but by no means all, religions. Practitioners of those religions understandably resented the insight being attributed to an alien machine. If the acceptance of a new insight on our place in the universe represents a religious conversion, she mused, then a theological revolution was sweeping the Earth. Even the American and European Kiliasts had been influenced by Mashindo. But if the machine didn't work, and the message went away, how long, she wondered, would the insight last? Even if we had made some mistake in interpretation or construction, she thought, even if we never understood anything more about the Vegans, the message demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that there were other beings in the universe, and that they were more advanced than we. That should help keep the planet unified for a while, she thought. She asked Ada if he had ever had a transforming religious experience. Yes, he said. When? Sometimes you had to encourage him to talk. When I first picked up Euclid. Also, when I first understood Newtonian gravitation, and Maxwell's equations, and general relativity, and during my work on superunification, I have been fortunate enough to have had many religious experiences. No, she returned. You know what I mean. Apart from science. Never, he replied instantly. Never apart from science. He told her a little of the religion he had been born into. He did not consider himself bound by all its tenets, he said, but he was comfortable with it. He thought it could do much good. It was a comparatively new sect, contemporaneous with Christian Science or the Jehovah's Witnesses, founded by Mirza Ghulam Ahmad in the Punjab. Devi apparently knew something about the Ahmadiyya as a proselytizing sect. It had been especially successful in West Africa. The origins of the religion were wrapped in eschatology. Ahmad had claimed to be the Mahdi, the figure Muslims expect to appear at the end of the world. He also claimed to be Christ come again, an incarnation of Krishna, and a Buruz, or reappearance of Muhammad. Christian Kiliasm had now infected the Ahmadiyya, and his reappearance was imminent according to some of the faithful. The year 2008, the centenary of Ahmad's death, was now a favored date for his final return as Mahdi. The global messianic fervor, while sputtering, seemed on average to be swelling still further, and Ellie confessed concern about the irrational predilections of the human species. At the festival of love, said Devi, you should not be such a pessimist. In Sapporo, there had been an abundant snowfall, and the local custom of making snow and ice sculptures of animals and mythological figures was updated. An immense dodecahedron had been meticulously carved and was shown regularly as a kind of icon on the evening news. After unseasonably warm days, the ice sculptors could be seen packing, chipping, and grinding, repairing the damage. That the activation of the machine might, one way or another, trigger a global apocalypse was a fear now often being voiced. The machine project responded with confident guarantees to the public, quiet assurances to the governments, and decrees to keep the activation time secret. Some scientists proposed activation on November 17th, an evening on which was predicted the most spectacular meteor shower of the century. An agreeable symbolism, they said. But Valerian argued that if the machine was to leave the Earth at that moment, having to fly through a cloud of cometary debris would provide an additional and unnecessary hazard. So activation was postponed for a few weeks, until the end of the last month of 1900 and anything. While this date was not literally the turn of the millennium, but a year before, celebrations on a lavish scale were planned by those who could not be bothered to understand the calendrical conventions, or who wished to celebrate the coming of the third millennium in two consecutive Decembers. Although the extraterrestrials could not have known how much each crew member weighed, they specified in painstaking detail the mass of each machine component and the total permissible mass. Very little was left over for equipment of terrestrial design. This fact had some years before been used as an argument for an all-woman crew, so that the equipment allowance could be increased. But the suggestion had been rejected as frivolous. There was no room for spacesuits. They would have to hope the Vegans would remember that humans had a propensity for breathing oxygen. With virtually no equipment of their own, with their cultural differences and their unknown destination, it was clear that the mission might entail great risk. The world press discussed it often. The five themselves, never. A variety of miniature cameras, spectrometers, superconducting supercomputers, and microfilm libraries were being urged on the crew. It made sense, and it didn't make sense. There were no sleeping or cooking or toilet facilities on board the machine. They were taking only a minimum of provisions, some of them stuffed in the pockets of their coveralls. Davy was to carry a rudimentary medical kit. As far as she was concerned, Ellie thought, she was barely planning to bring a toothbrush and a change of underwear. If they can get me to Vega in a chair, she thought, they'll probably be able to provide the amenities as well. If she needed a camera, she told project officials, she'd just ask the Vegans for one. There was a body of opinion, apparently serious, that the five should go naked, since clothing had not been specified it should not be included, because it might somehow disturb the functioning of the machine. Ellie and Davy, among many others, were amused and noted that there was no prescription against wearing clothing, a popular human custom evident in the Olympic broadcast. The Vegans knew we wore clothes, she and Vega protested. The only restrictions were on total mass. Should we also extract dental work, they asked, and leave eyeglasses behind? Their view carried the day, in part because of the reluctance of many nations to be associated with a project culminating so indecorously. But the debate generated a little raw humor among the press, the technicians, and the five. For that matter, Lunacharsky said, it doesn't actually specify that human beings are to go. Maybe they would find five chimpanzees equally acceptable. Even a single two-dimensional photograph of an alien machine could be invaluable, she was told. And imagine a picture of the aliens themselves. Would she please reconsider and bring a camera? Trahir, who was now on Hokkaido with a large American delegation, told her to be serious. The stakes were too high, he said, for... But she cut him short with a look so withering that he could not complete the sentence. In her mind, she knew what he was going to say. For childish behavior. Amazingly, Trahir was acting as if he had been the injured party in their relationship. She described it all to Davy, who was not fully sympathetic. Trahir, she said, was very sweet. Eventually, Ellie agreed to take an ultra-miniaturized video camera. In the manifest that the project required under personal effects, she listed frond, palm, 0.811 kilograms. Trahir was sent to reason with her. You know there's a splendid infrared imaging system you can carry along for 2/3 of a kilogram. Why would you want to take the branch of a tree? A frond. It's a palm frond. I know you grew up in New York, but you must know what a palm tree is. It's all in Ivanhoe. Didn't you read it in high school? At the time of the Crusades, pilgrims who made the long journey to the Holy Land took back a palm frond to show they'd really been there. It's to keep my spirits up. I don't care how advanced they are, the earth is my Holy Land. I'll bring a frond to them to show them where I came from. Trahir only shook his head. But when she described her reasons to Vege, he said, This I understand very well. Ellie remembered Vege's concerns, and the story he had told her in Paris about the droshky sent to the impoverished village. But this was not her worry at all. The palm frond served another purpose, she realized. She needed something to remind her of Earth. She was afraid she might be tempted not to come back. The day before the machine was to be activated, she received a small package that had been delivered by hand to her apartment on the site in Wyoming and transshipped by courier. There was no return address, and inside no note and no signature. The package held a gold medallion on a chain. Conceivably, it could be used as a pendulum. An inscription had been engraved on both sides, small but readable. One side read, Hera, superb queen with the golden robes, commanded Argus, whose glances bristle out through the world. On the obverse, she read, This is the response of the defenders of Sparta to the commander of the Roman army. If you are a god, you will not hurt those who have never injured you. If you are a man, advance, and you will find men equal to yourself. And women. She knew who had sent it. End of side 15.